At Byers Volkswagen, we've been family-owned since 1897, built on trust, driven by innovation. And now, buying your next Volkswagen is easier than ever. Shop online, customize your deal, and finalize everything from home. Just stop by to pick up the keys. It's that simple.
Drive home a new 2025 Volkswagen Taos S-FWD for $350 for 36 months with zero due at signing.
The next generation shops online, and we're driving with them at ColumbusVolkswagen.com or visit us by the airport.
See dealer for details. Offer ends 11/30/25.
Coda has turned up the frequency. Buses are running more often across Central Ohio. Starting this September, you'll see expanded weekend service on the east and north sides, including the Easton and Polaris corridors. Plus, there are added weekday trips downtown from New Albany, Canal, Winchester, and Tuttle. It's more service, more connections, and more ways to move across the city. Discover the enhanced schedule at coda.com/service changes. That's coda.com/service changes.
The first royal media war. Edward VIII, the abdication, and the press. The abdication crisis of 1936 demolished the wall of silent deference that had protected the British royal family from press comment and intrusion since the early days of Queen Victoria. It is the fascinating book of a struggle at the heart of the royal family and the increasing power of the press. Delighted to say I'm joined live on the line by the author of the first royal media war, Adrian Phillips. Adrian, good morning. Good morning to you.
Good morning, Charles.
Thank you for joining me this morning. We seem to think that the press having a pop at the monarchy, or certain sections of it, is a new invention, but it goes back to, well, almost 100 years ago now.
Absolutely not. The first thing to bear in mind is that Edward VIII was really the first celebrity royal, and he was built up not merely by the newspapers, but by the newsreels as well. Powerful force in those days. But it left the country with this image of this golden boy, young, handsome, sporty, open to contact with everybody, and a promise for the monarchy of the future. The sad thing is that Edward believed his own propaganda, and not like so many celebrities before and since, he thought, A, that status was permanent, and what was really dangerous, he thought that his popularity was going to give him the firepower to take on the government, not only on the idea of his marrying Wallis Simpson, but generally about the power of the monarchy.
I mean, yes, because he's taking on the government, and the government, he might be the embodiment of this fresh new age, this sort of not roaring 20s, but definitely roaring 30s. But the government is very much traditionalist, conservative with a capital C.
Well, there are two strikes against Wallis Simpson, the woman he wanted to marry. One, there's that she'd been divorced once already. She'd got another divorce coming up before she could marry anybody else, which in the morality of the time was bad enough. And that probably would have ruled her out of court for utter guess, two-thirds minimum of the British people. The other thing is that the government had all the reports from Special Branch and elsewhere showing the other stuff that Mrs. Simpson was up to, including her extra lover on top of the Prince of Wales, as he'd been then, and her husband.
Yes, that was certainly that would stoke a few things and raise a few eyebrows. And we forget now, don't we? But then back in the 1930s, I mean, divorce was very, very rare indeed, and something of a scandal.
Oh, yeah, it was a huge negative. I knew senior military officers, senior civil servants were pretty much expected to resign if they got involved or got dragged in front of the divorce court, which is the phrase that they kept using.
The popular narrative tends to be that if you like, Edward was besotted by Wallis, and therefore he would move any mountain for her. He booked no criticism of her, and this is why he was prepared to if you like, take on the media and take on the world for the love of his beloved Wallis Simpson.
He was not just taking on the media, because there was some media that was firmly in his court. In particular, the Harmsworth newspapers. Esmond Harmsworth was a particular friend of his. And just before the divorce court, they'd met up in Balmoral. I think, quite clearly to plot what the Daily Mail was going to do to help Edward out. And the first strike in that was when he visited South Wales, the abandoned steelworks, and came out with his famous pronouncement, something must be done. That was very aggressively covered by the Daily Mail. And yes, he genuinely had sympathy for the unemployed, but it was clearly part of a strategy to try and beat up the government, to threaten Stanley Baldwin, the Prime Minister, with, if you don't accept the marriage, there is more of this bad stuff about how you, the government, don't care about the unemployed, whilst the King does, to come. Stanley Baldwin, though, was a tough guy, experienced politician, and he called Harmsworth's bluff, he called Edward's bluff, and they had to fold.
So who were the major players then in the media? Is it Beaverbrook? Is it William Randolph Hearst? Who are the people who can make or break, or who Edward can call on as his allies, or are his chief opposition?
His big international ally was William Randolph Hearst, the model for Citizen Kane, the US press magnate. He was obsessed with the idea of giving Britain an American queen, Queen Wallis. And even before she got her second divorce, was running a story quite possibly fed to him by the King or Mrs. Simpson, who was on his payroll, saying that the King was going to marry Mrs. Simpson. So he was the big international ally. Domestically, as I said, there was Harmsworth. Beaverbrook was more interested in getting rid of Baldwin, whom he hated. He had no particular opinion on the King. That was on one side. On the other side, you had the conservative media, which was probably less influential than it thought it was. You had Geoffrey Dawson, the editor of the Times, who really thought he was a national-level statesman and was desperately keen to get involved. I think Baldwin saw through him and saw he needed a much simpler press outlet, and he had the Daily Telegraph under Lord Kelmsley, who just responded to what Baldwin wanted to do and put out the statements that were due. The other media figure who was very important was Sir John Rees, Director General of the BBC, who was able to make certain that the government's ruling was respected when the King wanted to broadcast to the British people over the heads of the government to try and make his popularity stick. The government certainly forbade that, and Rees was a loyal government servant, and he made absolutely certain that the King did not broadcast.
What sort of circulation, readership, are we talking now? Because obviously, now these days, people very rarely, I think, buy an old-fashioned newspaper. You get it through your phone, digitally, etc. But what was the readership, do you know, of those broadsheets of the papers of the time?
What you can probably fairly say is that it must be something like 90% of the British people would have read a newspaper of one sort or another every single day. So that was the dominant channel of news and information for people, and that's where they got their truth from. After the abdication, Lord Beaverbrook did a very biased count-up and came up with a bigger readership for his and for Harmsworth's papers than for the Times and the Telegraph, which were clearly pro-government. But that was a pretty false calculation. He was leaving out papers that wobbled and came over to the government side in the course of the crisis. Unfortunately, there's no way of calculating what the balance of public opinion was. It was before opinion polls, really, before mass observation. But I think, at a guess, two-thirds of the public would have supported the government, and possibly a third the King, but it's very hard to guess.
And so you said a little bit earlier that Wallace was on Randolph Hearst's payroll. So, well, was she working for him, or was he paying her for some sort of influence?
The exact details aren't known, but what is a fact is that the government knew about it. The government had very good intelligence sources through the crisis. They won the intelligence war, hands down, and one of the targets of the operation was the relationship between Mrs. Simpson, and possibly the King as well, and William Randolph Hearst. And one of the key bits of information that it provided was that she was being paid by Hearst. And going back to an earlier point, the government's low opinion of Mrs. Simpson was pretty much totally confirmed by this kind of information.
What was Edward's reaction then, as he sees what he says the sections of the media, especially the BBC, turn against him, and indeed his own family? He ostracised him, and you know the saying is, you know, history doesn't repeat itself, but it certainly has echoes.
His delusion that his popularity would carry him through exploded when the press silence in Britain about the crisis crumbled. It was broken by two provincial newspapers, the Yorkshire Post and the Birmingham Mail. He'd been due to visit the Midlands, which might have been a plan to restage the big coup of the visit to South Wales. But what he found was that the provincial newspapers were solidly against him. And there's a wonderful description of him that evening seeing the Prime Minister clutching a copy of the Birmingham paper saying, "They don't want me. They don't want me." That was a brutal blow to him. It meant that his dream that his popularity would carry him through was wrong.
And also, because you said that obviously there was almost like a packed wall of silence, shall we say, with the papers. Nobody was going to crumble. But also within the institutions themselves, within the government and the court, people started to sort of peel off and break rank and come up with some juicy tidbits.
The press silence was pretty extraordinary. It's a relic of the previous extreme deference that was given to the royal family, and the crisis was a watershed. Afterwards, things were utterly different. Within the establishment, as the crisis built, there was a tendency to say, well, really, this is a problem for the Prime Minister Baldwin. We're going to leave it to him. So the crisis as it plays out is very much a two-hander between the King and the Baldwin, with pretty much everybody on the sidelines.
And I suppose one of the things is that this is the beginning of what we have today, because suddenly the monarchy, their inner lives are laid out to the public. But, you know, you could say it was a watershed moment, in the way that the Queen invited the cameras into the house. And what was it, 67, 68? And that was obviously a more stage managed production. But for this time in 1936, the British public are treated to seeing the royal family, royal warts and all.
Yep, it's not immediately apparent just how bad things had become. The year after the abdication, you could just about start seeing it happening, but you had to do the analysis yourself. You had to say, oh, why is almost nobody at the Duke of Windsor's wedding? And also, why is the Duchess of Windsor not becoming a Royal Highness? Those were public pieces of data, and you could draw conclusions from them. But there was very little of the surrounding narrative that we would be bombarded with today. And even in the rest of his life, whilst the Duke of Windsor was pursuing a big vendetta, it was really against Stanley Baldwin, who'd so outmaneuvered him. He complained that his wife was not allowed to be a Royal Highness, but the kind of real dirt that we see now was not on show. As things went on, as the Duchess of Windsor published her own memoirs in the mid-50s, yes, you started seeing it. But interestingly enough, the person who really put the boot in to expose the feud between herself and the Duchess of Windsor was the Queen Mother, who... while at the moment when the Duchess of Windsor was no longer in a position to reply, authorised her circle, her courtiers, to give a friendly author the full dirt.
Yes, the Queen Mother was a master of manoeuvring. I mean, it's a situation, isn't it, where you know Edward and Wallace Simpson, they were defeated basically, and they were cast out, and the rest of their life seems to be a sort of it's not a tragedy, but you get the feeling that they never really recovered from this, did they? Because they basically spend, I mean, everybody knows about the visit to Germany in the 30s, and then some pretty shall we say devious sort of meddlings around Europe, and then they seem to be on permanent tour around any nation that would have them.
The king, as he was then, was really in too much of a hurry to abdicate. He wanted to marry Wallace, and that was the important thing. Negotiating with his brother, he prioritized money. He didn't follow through to think what was going to happen after he abdicated. Going abroad for a while was expected everywhere and in itself was no particular surprise. The Duke himself didn't have a problem with it. It's just he didn't expect it really to be for the rest of his life. He sort of hoped that he would be let back into the country as a kind of official, wise older brother guiding the new king, but the principle of monarchy is that you have one monarch and that's it. So even if it was ever well formulated, that the Duke of Windsor was completely wrong on that point. So exile and the life of an international playboy was pretty much all that was left him.
What gave you the spark? Why did you decide the time was ripe to write this book?
I was commissioned to write it in December 2021, so well before, it was after Megxit, but well before the ruckus over Spare developed. And it also tells you about how the government was concerned about how it had handled the crisis, but keeping quiet how it had handled the crisis. The kind of eureka moment goes into the early 1950s when Lord Beaverbrook is trying to put out his own version of the crisis. And one of the points he wants to focus on is how the government used the threat, the implied threat of interfering with Mrs. Simpson's divorce as a tool to keep the Duke of Windsor in order. And when you peel away the layers of onion skin, there was some pretty rough stuff going on there. And that is what the government, in the person of the then Home Secretary, Sir John Simon, wanted to keep really quiet. And Beaverbrook approached him for a comment, and unfortunately there is no record of that lunch, but clearly Simon wheeled out some pretty powerful guns. I rather suspect it was something like the special branch reports into Mrs. Simpson's private life, which put him firmly back in his box. But that was something which was important to keep quiet even then.
What do you hope the people take from your book, The First Royal Media War?
As you kind of said, there is nothing new under the sun. Monarchy has always been about image and projection. Go right back into the Middle Ages, and how the monarch presented him or herself was a vital component. Obviously, you didn't have media to remotely the same extent as you have now, but public projection was critical. the 100 years truce after the Queen Victoria came to the throne is kind of the outlier. That is the exception. What Edward did in the abdication crisis was, in effect, to boot the monarch's image and public standing back into centre stage. And there it has stayed ever since, responding to, first of all, the technological media and as they developed, and then also changing public fashions and standing and image of the monarch itself.
The book is called The First Royal Media War, Edward the Eighth, The Abdication and the Press. It's by Adrian Phillips, who we're talking to today. Adrian, if people want to find more about the book or about yourself, where can they find you? Is there a website? Is there social media?
My website is adrianphillips.co.uk, and that will lead you into my Twitter feed, which is at Adrian G Phillips, my blog, everything. But go first to the website, adrianphillips.co.uk.
The book is called The First Royal Media War. It's by Adrian Phillips, who'll be speaking to you today. Adrian, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you, Giles. Bye-bye.
At Ability Chiropractic, we believe every child deserves to grow up healthy, strong, and connected to the incredible power within their own body. From infants to adults, our doctors specialize in purposeful chiropractic care that restores balance between the brain and body, helping you and your family live and heal the way you were designed to, naturally. Families across Columbus are choosing to build lifelong wellness from the start. Discover what true health feels like at Ability Chiropractic. Schedule your visit today at abilitychiro.com.
COTA has turned up the frequency. Buses are running more often across Central Ohio. Starting this September, you'll see expanded weekend service on the east and north sides, including the Easton and Polaris corridors. Plus, there are added weekday trips downtown from New Albany, Canal, Winchester, and Tuttle. It's more service, more connections, and more ways to move across the city. Discover the enhanced schedule at coda.com/service changes. That's coda.com/service changes.
There's still time to get holiday ready. Right Rug Flooring makes it easy with next day installation and 24-month special financing with approved credit. Carpet, hardwood, luxury vinyl, and tile. We have everything you need to make your home shine for family and friends this season. Schedule a free in-home estimate or find a showroom near you. Visit rightrug.com. RITERUG.com. Be holiday ready with Right Rug Flooring.
Right here, right now.